Seppel's rooms, up three flights of stairs, were dark and close in the heat of this late summer. He took them up one more steep flight onto the roof. It was joined to other roofs by a bridge on each side, so that there was a regular crossroads and thoroughfare across it. Awnings were set up by the low parapets, and the breeze from the harbor cooled the shaded air. There they sat on striped canvas mats in the corner that was Seppel's bit of the roof, and he gave them a cool, slightly bitter tea to drink. He was a short man of about 50, round-bodied, with small hands and feet, hair that was a little curly and unruly, and what was rare among men of the archipelago, a beard clipped short on his dark cheeks and jaw. His manners were pleasant. He spoke in a clipped, singing accent, softly. He and Onyx talked, and Alder listened for a good while to them. His mind drifted when they spoke about people and matters of which he knew nothing. He looked out over the roofs and awnings, the roof gardens, and the arched and carven bridges, northward to Mount On, a great pale-gray dome above the hazy hills of summer. He came back to himself, hearing the Pelnish wizard say, "It may be that even the archmage could not wholly heal the wound in the world." The wound in the world, Alder thought. Yes. He looked more intently at Seppel, and Seppel glanced at him. For all the soft look of the man, his eyes were sharp. "Maybe it's not only our desire to live forever that has kept the wound open," Seppel said, "but the desire of the dead to die." Again Alder heard the strange words and felt that he recognized them without understanding them. Again Seppel glanced at him as if seeking a response. Alder said nothing, nor did Onyx speak. Seppel said at last, "When you stand at the bourne, Master Alder, what is it they ask of you?"
"To be free," Alder replied, his voice only a whisper.
"Free," Onyx murmured. Silence again. Two girls and a boy ran past across the roofway, laughing and calling, "Down at the next!" playing one of the endless games of chase children made with their city's maze of streets and canals and stairs and bridges. "Maybe it was a bad bargain from the beginning," Seppel said, and when Onyx looked a question at him, he said, "Varroa Nadan." Alder knew the words were in the old speech, but he did not know their meaning. He looked at Onyx, whose face was very grave. Onyx said only, "Well, I hope we can come to the truth of these things, and soon."
"On the hill where truth is," Seppel said. "I'm glad you'll be with us there. Meanwhile, here is Alder summoned to the bourne night after night and seeking some reprieve. I said that you might know a way to help him."
"And you would accept the touch of the wizardry of palm?" Seppel asked Alder. His tone was softly ironic. His eyes were bright and hard as jet. Alder's lips were dry.
"Master," he said, "we say on my island, the man drowning doesn't ask what the rope cost. If you can keep me from that place even for a night, you'll have my heart's thanks, little as that is worth, in return for such a gift."
Onyx looked at him with a slight, amused, unreproving smile. Seppel did not smile at all.
"Thanks are rare in my trade," he said. "I would do a good deal for them. I think I can help you, Master Alder, but I have to tell you, the rope is a costly one."
Alder bowed his head.
"You come to the bourne in dream, not by your own will. That is so?"
"So I believe."
"Wisely said." Seppel's keen glance approved him. Who knows his own will clearly? "But if it is in dream you go there, I can keep you from that dream.
for a while, and at a cost, as I said.
Alder looked his question.
Your power.
Alder did not understand him at first. Then he said,
My gift, you mean? My art?
Seppel nodded.
I'm only a mender, Alder said after a little time. It's not a great power to give up.
Onyx made as if to protest, but looked at Alder's face and said nothing.
It is your living, Seppel said.
It was my life once, but that's gone.
Maybe your gift will come back to you when what must happen has happened. I cannot promise that. I will try to restore what I can of what I take from you. But we're all walking in the night now on ground we don't know. When the day comes, we may know where we are, or we may not. Now, if I spare you your dream at that price, will you thank me?
I will, Alder said. What's the little good of my gift against the great evil my ignorance could do? If you spare me the fear I live in now, the fear that I may do that evil, I'll thank you till the end of my life.
Seppel drew a deep breath. I've always heard that the harps of town play true, he said.
He looked at Onyx.
And Roke has no objection, he asked, with a return to his mild, ironic tone.
Onyx shook his head, but he now looked very grave.
Then we will go to the cave at Auron, tonight, if you like.
Why there? Onyx asked.
Because it's not I, but the earth that will help Alder. Auron is a sacred place, full of power. Although the people of Havnor have forgotten that and use it only to defile it,
Onyx managed to have a private word with Alder before they followed Seppel downstairs.
You need not go through with this, Alder, he said.
I thought I trusted Seppel, but I don't know now.
I'll trust him, Alder said.
He understood Onyx's doubts, but he had meant what he said, that he would do anything to be free of the fear of doing some dreadful wrong.
Each time he had been drawn back in dream to that wall of stones, he felt that something was trying to come into the world through him, that it would do so if he listened to the dead calling to him, and each time he heard them, he was weaker, and it was harder to resist their call.
The three men went a long way through the city streets in the heat of the late afternoon. They came out into the countryside south of the city, where rough, ridgy hills ran down to the bay, a poor bit of country for this rich island. Swampy lowland between the ridges, a little arable land on their rocky backs. The wall of the city here was very old, built of great unmortared rocks taken from the hills, and beyond it there were no suburbs and few farms. They walked along a rough road that zigzagged up the first ridge and followed its crest eastward towards the higher hills. Up there, where they could see all the city lying in a golden haze northward to their left, the road widened out into a maze of footpaths. Going straight forward, they came suddenly to a great crack in the ground, a black gap 20 feet wide or more, right across their way. It was as if the spine of rock had been cracked apart by a wrenching of the earth and had never healed again. The western sunlight streaming over the lips of the cave lighted the vertical rock faces a little way down, but below that was darkness. There was a tannery in the valley under the ridge, south of it. The tanners had brought their wastes up here and dumped them into the crack, carelessly, so that all around it was a litter of rancid scraps of half-cured leather and a stink of rot and urine. There was another smell from the depths of the cave as they approached the sheer edge, a cold, sharp, earthy air that made Alder draw back. I grieve for this. I grieve for this, the Wizard of Palm said aloud, looking around at the rubbish and down at the roofs of the tannery with a strange expression. But he spoke to Alder after a while in his usual mild way. This is the cave, or cleft, called Auron, that we know from our most ancient maps in Palm, where it is also called the Lips of Power. It used to speak to the people here when they first came here from the west, a long time ago. Men have changed, but it is what it was then. Here you can lay down your burden, if that is what you want. What must I do? Alder said. Supple led him to the south end of the great split in the ground, where it narrowed back together in fissured ridges of rock. He told him to lie face down, where he could gaze into the depth of darkness stretching down and down away from him. Hold to the earth, he said. That is all you must do. Even if it moves, hold to it. Alder lay there, staring down between the walls of stone. He felt rocks jabbing his chest and hip as he lay on them. He heard Seppel begin to chant in a high voice, in words he knew were the language of the making. He felt the warmth of the sun across his shoulders and smelled the carrion stink of the tannery. Then the breath of the cave blew up out of the depths with a hollow sharpness that took his own breath away and made his head spin. The darkness moved up towards him. The ground moved under him, rocked and shook, and he held on to it, hearing the high voice sing, breathing the breath of the earth. The darkness rose up and took him. He lost the sun. When he came back, the sun was low in the west, a red ball in the haze over the western shores of the bay. He saw that. He saw Seppel sitting nearby on the ground, looking tired and forlorn, his black shadow long on the rocky ground among the long shadows of the rocks. There you are, Onyx said. Alder realized that he was lying on his back, his head on Onyx's knees, a rock digging into his backbone. He sat up, dizzy, apologizing. They set off as soon as he could walk, for they had some miles to go, and it was clear that neither he nor Supple would be able to keep a fast pace. Full night had fallen when they came by Boatwright Street. Supple bade them farewell, looking searchingly at Alder as they stood in the light from a tavern door nearby. I did as you asked me, he said, with that same unhappy look. I thank you for it, Alder said, and put out his right hand to the wizard in the manner of the people of the Enlides. After a moment, Supple touched it with his hand, and so they parted. Alder was so tired he could barely make his legs move. The sharp, strange taste of the air from the cave was still in his mouth and throat, making him feel light. Light-headed, hollow. When at last they came to the palace, Onyx wanted to see him to his room, but Alder said he was well and only needed a rest. He came into his room, and Tug came dancing and tail-waving to greet him. I don't need you now, Alder said, bending down to stroke the sleek gray back. Tears came into his eyes. It was only that he was very tired. He lay down on the bed, and the cat jumped up and curled up, purring on his shoulder. And he slept. Black, blank sleep with no dream he could remember, no voice calling his name, no hill of dry grass, no dim wall of stones. Nothing.
Walking in the gardens of the palace in the evening before they were to sail south, Tanar was heavy-hearted and anxious. She did not want to be setting off to Roke, the Isle of the Wise, the Isle of the Wizards. Accursed sorcerers, a voice in her mind said in Kargish. What had she to do there? What possible use could she be? She wanted to go home to Gaunt, to Ged, to her own house, her own work, her own dear man. She had estranged Labanon. She had lost him. He was polite, affable, and unforgiving. How men feared women, she thought, walking among the late flowering roses. Not as individuals, but women when they talked together, worked together, spoke up for one another. Then men saw plots, cabals, constraints, traps being laid. Of course, they were right. Women were likely, as women, to take the next generation's part, not this one's. They wove the links men saw as chains, the bonds men saw as bondage. She and Sesarach were indeed in league against him and ready to betray him if he truly was nothing unless he was independent, if he was only air and fire, no weight of earth to him, no patient water. But that was not Labanon so much as Tehanu, unearthly, her Theru, the winged soul that had come to stay with her for a while and was soon, she knew, to leave her, from fire to fire. And Irion, with whom Tehanu would go. What had that bright, fierce creature to do with an old house that needed sweeping, an old man who needed looking after? How could Irion understand such things? What was it to her, a dragon, that a man should undertake his duty, marry, have children, wear the yoke of earth? Seeing herself alone and useless among beings of high, inhuman destiny, Tanar gave in altogether to homesickness. Homesickness not for Gaunt only. Why should she not be in league with Sesarach, who might be a princess as she herself had been a priestess, but who was not going to be flying off on fiery wings, being deeply and entirely a woman of the earth? And she spoke Tanar's own language. Tanar had dutifully tutored her in Hardik, had been delighted with her quickness to learn, and realized only now that the true delight had been just to speak Kargish with her, hearing and saying words that held in them all her lost childhood. As she came to the walk that led to the fish ponds beneath the willows, she saw Alder. With him was a small boy. They were talking quietly, soberly. She was always glad to see Alder. She pitied him for the pain and fear he was in, and honored his patience in bearing it. She liked his honest, handsome face and his silver tongue. What was the harm in adding a grace note or two to ordinary speech? Yet had trusted him. Pausing at a distance so as not to disturb the conversation, she saw him and the child kneel down on the path, looking into the bushes. Presently, Alder's little gray cat emerged from under a bush. It paid no attention to them, but set off across the grass, paw by paw, belly low and eyes alight, hunting a moth. "You can let him stay out all night if you like," Alder said to the child. "He can't stray or come to harm here. He has a great taste for the open air. But this is like all Havnor to him, you see, these great gardens. Or you can give him his freedom in the mornings. And then, if you like, he can sleep with you." "I would like that," the boy said, shyly decisive. "Then he needs his box of sand in your room, you know, and a bowl of drinking water, never to go dry. And food." "Yes, indeed, once a day. Not too much of it. He's a bit greedy. Inclined to think Segoy made the island so that Tug could fill his belly."
"Does he catch fish in the pond?"
The cat was now near one of the carp pools, sitting on the grass, looking about. The moth had flown. "He likes to watch them."
"I do too," the boy said.
They got up and walked together towards the pools. Tanar was moved to tenderness. There was an innocence to Alder, but it was a man's innocence, not childish. He should have had children of his own. He would have been a good father to them. She thought of her own children, and of the little grandchildren, though Apple's eldest, Pippin. Was it possible? Was Pippin about to be 12? She would be named this year or next. Oh, it was time to go home. It was time to visit Middle Valley, take a name day present to her granddaughter and toys to the babies, make sure Spark in his restlessness wasn't over pruning the pear trees again, sit a while and talk with her kind daughter, Apple. Apple's true name was Hiohe, the name Ogion had given her. The thought of Ogion came as always with a pang of love and longing. She saw the hearth place of the house at Rayalby. She saw Ged sitting there at the hearth. She saw him turn his dark face to ask her a question. She answered it aloud in the gardens of the new palace of Havnor, hundreds of miles from that hearth. "As soon as I can." In the morning, the bright summer morning, they all went down from the palace to go aboard the Dolphin. The people of the city of Havnor made it a festival, swarming afoot in the streets and on the wharves, choking the canals with the little poled boats they called chips, dotting the great bay with sailboats and dinghies all flying bright flags, and flags and pennants flew from the towers of the great houses and the banner poles on bridges high and low. Passing among these cheerful crowds, Tanar thought of the day long ago she and Ged came sailing into Havnor, bringing home the rune of peace, Elfaran's ring. That ring had been on her arm, and she had held it up so the silver would flash in the sunlight and the people could see it. And they had cheered and held out their arms to her as if they all wanted to embrace her. It made her smile to think of that. She was smiling as she went up the gangplank and bowed to Labanum. He greeted her with the traditional formality of a ship's master. "Mistress Tanar, be welcome aboard." She replied, moved by she knew not what impulse. "I thank you, son of Elfaran." He looked at her for a moment, startled by that name. But Tehanu followed close after her, and he repeated the formal greeting. "Mistress Tehanu, be welcome aboard." Tanar went on towards the prow of the ship, remembering a corner there near a capstan where a passenger could be out of the way of the hard-working sailors and yet see all that happened on the crowded deck and outside the ship, too. There was a commotion in the main street leading to the dock. The High Princess was arriving. Tanar saw with satisfaction that Labanon, or perhaps his majordomo, had arranged for the princess's arrival to be fittingly magnificent. Mounted escorts opened a way through the crowds, their horses snorting and clattering in fine style. Tall red plumes, such as Kargish warriors wore on their helmets, waved from the top of the closed, gilt-bedizened carriage that had brought the princess across the city and on the headstalls of the four gray horses that drew it. A band of musicians waiting on the waterside struck up with trumpet, tambour, and tambourine, and the people, discovering that they had a princess to cheer and peer at, cheered loudly and pressed as close as the horsemen and foot guards would allow them, gaping and full of praises and somewhat random greetings. "Hail the Queen of the Kargs," some of them shouted, and others, "She ain't," and others, "Look at 'em all in red, fine as rubies. Which one is her?" And others, "Long live the princess!" Tanar saw Sesarach, veiled, of course, from hat to foot, but unmistakable by her height and bearing, descend from the carriage and sail, stately as a ship herself, towards the gangplank. Two of her shorter-veiled attendants trotted close behind her, followed by Lady Opal of Ilion. Tanar's heart sank. Labanon had decreed that no servants or followers were to be taken on this journey. It was not a cruise or pleasure trip, he had said sternly, and those aboard must have good reason to be aboard. Had Sesarach not understood that? Or did she so cling to her silly countrywomen that she meant to defy the king? That would be a most unfortunate beginning of the voyage. But at the foot of the gangplank, the gold-rippling red cylinder stopped and turned. It put forth hands, gold-skinned hands shining with gold rings. The princess embraced her handmaidens, clearly bidding them farewell. She also embraced Lady Opal in the approved, stately manner of royalty and nobility in public. Then Lady Opal herded the handmaidens back towards the carriage, while the princess turned again to the gangplank. There was a pause. Tanar could see that featureless column of red and gold take a deep breath. It drew itself up taller. It proceeded up the gangplank, slowly, for the tide had been rising and the angle was steep, but with an unhesitant dignity that kept the crowds ashore silent, fascinated, watching. It attained the deck and stopped there, facing the king. "High Princess of the Kargad Lands, be welcome aboard," Labanon said in a ringing voice. At that, the crowds burst out, "Hurrah for the princess! Long live the queen! Well walked ready!" Labanon said something to the princess, which the cheering made inaudible to others. The red column turned to the crowd on the waterside and bowed, stiff-backed but gracious. Tehanu had waited for her near where the king stood, and now came forward and spoke to her and led her to the aft cabin of the ship, where the heavy, soft-flowing red and golden veils disappeared. The crowd cheered and called more wildly than ever. "Come back, princess! Where's Reddy? Where's our lady? Where's the queen?" Tanar looked down the length of the ship at the king. Through her misgivings and heaviness of heart, unruly laughter welled up in her. She thought, "Poor boy, what will you do now? They've fallen in love with her the first chance they got to see her, even though they can't see her. Oh, Labanon, we're all in league against you." Dolphin was a fair-sized ship, fitted out to carry a king in some state and comfort. But first and foremost she was made to sail, to fly with the wind, to take him where he needed to go as quickly as could be. Accommodations were cramped enough when it was only the crew and officers, the king and a few companions aboard. On this voyage to Roque, accommodations were jammed. The crew, to be sure, were in no more than usual discomfort, sleeping down in the 3-foot-high kennel of the forward hold. But the officers had to share one wretched black closet under the forecastle. As for the passengers, all 4 women were in what was normally the king's cabin, which ran the narrow width of the sterncastle of the ship, while the cabin beneath it, usually occupied by the ship's master and 1 or 2 other officers, was shared by the king, the 2 wizards, the sorcerer, and Tosla. The probability of misery and bad temper was, Tanar thought, limitless. The first and most urgent probability, however, was that the High Princess was going to be sick. They were sailing down the Great Bay with the mildest following wind, the water calm, the ship gliding along like a swan on a pond. But Sesarach cowered on her bunk, crying out in despair whenever she looked out through her veils and caught sight of the sunny, peaceful vista of unexcited water, the mild white wake of the ship through the broad stern windows. "It will go up and down," she moaned in Kargish. "It is not going up and down at all," Tanar said. "Use your head, princess." "It is my stomach, not my head," Sesarach whimpered. "Nobody could possibly be seasick in this weather. You are simply afraid." "Mother," Tahanu protested, understanding the tone, if not the words. "Don't scold her. It's miserable to be sick." "She is not sick," Tanar said. She was absolutely convinced of the truth of what she said. "Sesarach, you are not sick. You are afraid of being sick. Get hold of yourself. Come out on deck. Fresh air will make all the difference. Fresh air and courage."
"Oh, my friend," Sesarach murmured in Hardic. "Make me courage."
Tanar was a little taken aback. "You have to make it yourself, princess," she said. Then relenting, "Come on. Just try it out on deck for a minute. Tahanu, see if you can persuade her. Think what she'll suffer if we do meet some weather." Between them, they got Sesarach to her feet and into her cylinder of red veiling, without which she could not, of course, appear before the eyes of men. They coaxed and wheedled her to creep out of the cabin, onto the bit of deck to the side of it, in the shade, where they could all sit in a row on the bone-white, impeccable decking and look out at the blue and shining sea. Sesarach parted her veils enough that she could see straight in front of her, but she mostly looked at her lap with an occasional brief, terrified glance at the water, after which she shut her eyes and looked down at her lap again. Tanar and Tahanu talked a little, pointing out ships that passed, birds, and island. "It's lovely. I forgot how I like to sail," Tanar said. "I like it if I can forget the water," said Tahanu. "It's like flying."
"Ah, you dragons," Tanar said.
It was spoken lightly, but it was not lightly said. It was the first time she had ever said anything of the kind to her adopted daughter. She was aware that Tahanu had turned her head to look at her with her seeing eye. Tanar's heart beat heavily. "Air and fire," she said. Tahanu said nothing, but her hand, the brown, slender hand, not the claw, reached out and took hold of Tanar's hand and held it tightly.
"I don't know what I am, mother,"
she whispered in her voice that was seldom more than a whisper.
"I do," Tanar said,
and her heart beat heavier and harder than before.
"I'm not like Irian," Tahanu said.
She was trying to comfort her mother, to reassure her, but there was longing in her voice, yearning jealousy, profound desire.
"Wait, wait and find out," her mother replied, finding it hard to speak.
"You'll know what to do, what you are,
when the time comes."
They were talking so softly that the princess could not hear what they said, if she could understand it. They had forgotten her. But she had caught the name Irian, and parting her veils with her long hands and turning to them, her eyes looking out bright from the warm red shadow, she asked,
"Irian? She is?"
"Somewhere forward, up there," Tanar waved at the rest of the ship.
"She makes herself courage, huh?"
After a moment, Tanar said, "She doesn't need to make it, I think. She's fearless."
"Ah," the princess.
Her bright eyes were gazing out of shadow all the length of the ship, to the prow where Irion stood beside Labanon. The king was pointing ahead, gesturing, talking with animation. He laughed, and Irion, standing by him, as tall as he, laughed too.
"Barefaced,"
Sesarach muttered in Kargish. And then in Hardic, thoughtfully, almost inaudibly,
"Fearless."
She closed her veils and sat, featureless, unmoving.
The long shores of Havner were blue behind them. Mount An floated faint and high in the north. The black basalt columns of the Isle of Omer towered off the ship's right side as she worked across the Abavner Straits towards the inmost sea. The sun was bright, the wind fresh, another fine day. All the women were sitting under the sailcloth awning the sailors had rigged for them beside the after cabin. Women brought good luck to a ship, and the sailors couldn't do enough for them in the way of ingenious little comforts and amenities. Because wizards could bring good luck, or equally bad luck, to a ship, the sailors also treated the wizards very well. Their awning was rigged in a corner of the quarter-deck, where they had a good view forward. The women had velvet cushions to sit on, provided by the king's forethought, or his majordomos. The wizards had packets of sailcloth, which did very well.
Alder found himself treated as, and considered to be, one of the wizards. He could do nothing about it, though it embarrassed him lest Onyx and Seppel should think he was claiming equality with them. And it also troubled him, because he was now not even a sorcerer. His gift was gone. He had no power at all. He knew it as surely as he would have known the loss of his sight, the paralysis of his hand. He could not have mended a broken pitcher now, unless with glue, and he would have done it badly because he had never had to do it. And beyond the craft he had lost was something else, something larger than the craft that was gone. Its loss left him, as his wife's death had, in a blankness in which no joy, no new thing was or would ever be. Nothing could happen. Nothing could change. Not having known of this larger aspect of his gift till he lost it, he pondered on it, wondering about its nature. It was like knowing the way to go, he thought, like knowing the direction of home. Not a thing one could identify or even say much about, but a connection on which everything else depended. Without it, he was desolate. He was useless. But at least he did no harm. His dreams were fleeting, meaningless. They never took him to those dreary moorlands, the hill of dead grass, the wall. No voices called him to the dark. He thought often of Sparrowhawk, wishing he could talk with him. The archmage who had spent all his power, and having been great among the great, now lived his life out poor and disregarded. Yet the king longed to show him honor, so Sparrowhawk's poverty was by choice. Perhaps, Alder thought, riches or high estate would have been only shameful to a man who had lost his true wealth, his way. Onyx clearly regretted having led Alder to make this trade or bargain. He had always been entirely civil to Alder, but he now treated him with regard and compunction, while his manner to the Wizard of Palm had become a little distant. Alder himself felt no resentment toward Seppel and no distrust of his intentions. The old powers were the old powers. You used them at your risk. Seppel had told him what he must pay, and he had paid it. He had not understood quite how much there was to pay, but that was not Seppel's fault. It was his own, for never having valued his gift at its true worth. So he sat with the two wizards, thinking of himself as false coin to their gold, but listening to them with all his mind. For they trusted him, and spoke freely, and their talk was an education he had never dreamed of as a sorcerer. Sitting there in the bright pale shade of the canvas awning, they talked of a bargain, a greater bargain than the one he had made to stop his dreams. Onyx said more than once the words of the old speech Seppel had spoken on the rooftop. Verowa Nadan. As they talked,
little by little, Alder gathered that the meaning of those words was something like a choice, a division, making two things of one. Far, far back in time, before the kings of Enlad, before the writing of Hardik, maybe before there was a Hardik tongue, when there was only the language of the making, it seemed that people had made some kind of choice, given up one great power or possession to gain another. The wizards' talk of this was hard to follow, not so much because they hid anything, but because they themselves were groping after things lost in the cloudy past, the time before memory. Words of the old speech came into their talk of necessity, and sometimes Onyx spoke entirely in that tongue. But Seppel would answer him in Hardik. Seppel was sparing with the words of the making. Once he held up his hand to stop Onyx from going on, and at the Roke wizard's look of surprise and question, said mildly, "Spell words act." Alder's teacher Gannett, too, had called the words of the old speech spell words. "Each is a deed of power," he had said. "True word makes truth be." Gannett had been stingy with the spell words he knew, speaking them only at need, and when he wrote any rune but the common ones that were used to write Hardik, he erased it almost as he finished it. Most sorcerers were similarly careful, either to guard their knowledge for themselves or because they respected the power of the language of the making. Even Seppel, wizard as he was, with a far wider knowledge and understanding of those words, preferred not to use them in conversation, but to keep to ordinary language, which, if it allowed lies and errors, also permitted uncertainty and retraction. Perhaps that had been part of the great choice men made in ancient times, to give up the innate knowledge of the old speech, which they once shared with the dragons. Had they done so, Alder wondered, in order to have a language of their own, a language suited to mankind, in which they could lie, cheat, swindle, and invent wonders that never had been and would never be? The dragons spoke no speech but the old speech. Yet it was always said that dragons lied. Was it so? He wondered. If spell words were true, how could even a dragon use them to lie? Seppel and Onyx had come to one of the long, easy, thoughtful pauses in their conversation. Seeing that Onyx was, in fact, at least half asleep, Alder asked the Pelnish wizard softly, "Is it true that dragons can tell untruth in the true words?" The Pelnishman smiled. "That, so we say on Palm, is the very question Ath asked Orm 1,000 years ago in the ruins of Ontuego. Can a dragon lie?" the mage asked. And Orm replied, "No," and then breathed on him, burning him to ashes. But are we to believe the story, since it was only Orm who could have told it? "Infinite are the arguments of mages," Alder said to himself, but not aloud. Onyx had gone definitely to sleep, his head tilted back against the bulkhead, his grave, tense face relaxed. Seppel spoke, his voice even quieter than usual. "Alder, I hope you do not regret what we did at Auron. I know our friend thinks I did not warn you clearly enough." Alder said without hesitation, "I am content." Seppel inclined his dark head. Alder said presently, "I know that we try to keep the equilibrium, but the powers of the earth keep their own account. And theirs is a justice that is hard for men to understand." "That's it. I try to see why it was just that. My craft, I mean, that I must give up to free myself from that dream." What has the one to do with the other?
Seppel did not answer for a while, and then it was with a question. It was not by your craft that you came to the wall of stones.
Never, Alder said with certainty. I had no more power to go there if I willed it than I had to prevent myself from going.
So how did you come there?
My wife called me, and my heart went to her.
A longer pause. The wizard said, Other men have lost beloved wives.
So I said to my lord Sparrowhawk, and he said, That's true, and yet the bond between true lovers is as close as we come to what endures forever.
Across the wall of stones, no bond endures. Alder looked at the wizard, the swarthy, soft, keen-eyed face.
Why is it so? He said.
Death is the bond breaker.
Then why do the dead not die?
Seppel stared at him, taken aback.
I'm sorry, Alder said. I misspeak in my ignorance. What I mean is this. Death breaks the bond of soul with body, and the body dies. It goes back to the earth. But the spirit must go to that dark place and wear a semblance of the body and endure there.
For how long?
Forever?
In the dust and dusk there, without light or love or cheer at all?
I cannot bear to think of Lily in that place.
Why must she be there? Why can she not be...
His voice stumbled.
Be free.
Because the wind does not blow there, Seppel said.
His look was very strange, his voice harsh. It was stopped from blowing by the art of man.
He continued to stare at Alder, but only gradually did he begin to see him. The expression in his eyes and face changed. He looked away, up the beautiful white curve of the foresail, full of the breath of the northwest wind. He glanced back at Alder.
You know as much as I do of this matter, my friend, he said with almost his usual softness. But you know it in your body, your blood, in the pulse of your heart. And I know only words.
Old words.
So we had better get to Roke, where maybe the wise men will be able to tell us what we need to know. Or if they cannot, the dragons will, perhaps.
Or maybe it will be you who shows us the way.
That would be the blind man who led the seers to the cliff's edge indeed, Alder said with a laugh.
But we're at the cliff's edge already, with our eyes shut, said the Wizard of Palm.